get dressed, watch television. Goals do not state precisely what to do, where and how to move, what to pick up. To lead to actions, goals must be transformed into specific statements of what is to be done, statements that I call intentions. A goal is something to be achieved, often vaguely stated. An intention is a specific action taken to get to the goal. Yet even intentions are not specific enough to control actions. Suppose I am sitting in my armchair reading a book. It is dusk. The light has gotten dimmer and dimmer. I decide I need more light. That is the goal, get more light. My goal has to be translated into the intention that states the appropriate action in the world. Push the switch button on the lamp. There's more. I need to specify how to move my body, how to stretch to reach the light switch, how to extend my finger to push the button without knocking over the lamp. The goal has to be translated into an intention, which in turn has to be made into a specific action sequence, one that can control my muscles. Note that I could satisfy my goal with other action sequences, other intentions. If someone walked into the room and passed by the lamp, I might alter my intention from pushing the switch button to asking the other person to do it for me. The goal hasn't changed, but the intention and resulting action sequence have. The specific actions bridge the gap between what we would like to have done, our goals and intentions, and all possible physical actions. After we specify what actions to make, we must actually do them, the stage of execution. All in all, there are three stages that follow from the goal: intention, action sequence, and execution. See Figure 11. The evaluation side of things, checking up on what happened, has three stages. First, perceiving what happened in the world. Second, trying to make sense of it, interpreting it. And finally, comparing what happened with what was wanted. See Figure 12. There we have it. Seven stages of action. One for goals, three for execution, and three for evaluation. Refer to Figure 13. Forming the goal. Forming the intention. Specifying an action. Executing the action. Perceiving the state of the world. Interpreting the state of the world. Evaluating the outcome. The seven stages form an approximate model, not a complete psychological theory. In particular, the stages are almost certainly not discrete entities. Most behavior does not require going through all the stages in sequence, and most activities will not be satisfied by single actions. There must be numerous sequences, and the whole activity may last hours or even days. There is a continual feedback loop, in which the results of one activity are used to direct further ones, in which goals lead to sub-goals, intentions lead to sub-intentions. There are activities in which goals are forgotten, discarded, or reformulated. For many everyday tasks, goals and intentions are not well specified. They are opportunistic rather than planned. Opportunistic actions are those in which the behavior takes advantage of the circumstances. Rather than engage in extensive planning and analysis, the person goes about the day's activities and performs the intended actions if the relevant opportunity arises. Thus, we may not go out of our way to go to a shop or to the library or to ask a question of a friend. Rather, we go through the day's activities, and if we find ourselves at the shop, near the library, or encountering the friend, then we allow the opportunity to trigger the relevant activity. Otherwise, the task remains undone. Only in the case of crucial tasks do we make special efforts to ensure that they get done. Opportunistic actions are less precise and certain than specified goals and intentions, but they result in less mental effort, less inconvenience, and perhaps more interest. The seven-stage process of action can be started at any point. People do not always behave as full, logical, reasoning organisms, starting with high-level goals and working to achieve them. Our goals are often ill-formed and vague. We may respond to the events of the world in what is called data-driven behavior, rather than to think out plans and goals. An event in the world may trigger an interpretation and a resulting response. Actions may be executed before they are fully developed. In fact, some of us adjust our lives so that the environment can control our behavior. For example, sometimes when I must do an important task, I make a formal public promise to get it done by a certain date. I make sure that I will be reminded of the promise. And then, hours before the deadline, I actually get to work and do the job. This kind of behavior is fully compatible with the seven-stage analysis. The gulfs of execution and evaluation. Remember the movie projector story? People's problems threading the projector did not come from a lack of understanding of the goal or the task. It did not come from deep, subtle complexity. The difficulty lay entirely in determining the relationship between the intended actions and the mechanisms of the projector, in determining the functions of each of the controls, in determining what specific manipulation of each control enabled each function, and in deciding by the sights, sounds, lights, and movements of the projector whether the intended actions were being done successfully. The users had a problem with mappings and feedback, as they would have with the projector in Figure 14. The projector story is only an extreme case of the difficulties faced in the conduct of many tasks. For a surprisingly large number of everyday tasks, the difficulty resides entirely in deriving the relationship between the mental intentions and interpretations and the physical actions and states. There are several gulfs that separate mental states from physical ones. Each gulf reflects one aspect of the distance between the mental representations of the person and the physical components and states of the environment. And these gulfs present major problems for users. The gulf of execution. Does the system provide actions that correspond to the intentions of the person? The difference between the intentions and the allowable actions is the gulf of execution. One measure of this gulf is how well the system allows the person to do the intended actions directly, without extra effort. Do the actions provided by the system match those intended by the person? Consider the movie projector example. One problem resulted from the gulf of execution. The person wanted to set up the projector. Ideally, this would be a simple thing to do, but no, a long, complex sequence was required. It wasn't at all clear what actions had to be done to accomplish the intentions of setting up the projector and showing the film. Self-threading projectors do exist. These nicely bridge the gulf. Or look at VCRs. They have the same mechanical problem as film projectors. The videotape has to be threaded through their mechanism. But the solution is to hide this part of the system, to put the task on the machine, not the person. So the machinery bridges the gulf. All the user has to do is plop in the cartridge and push the start button. It's a pity the film companies are so far behind. Well, in a while it won't matter. There won't be any film. Just videotape. The gulf of evaluation. Does the system provide a physical representation that can be directly perceived and that is directly interpretable in terms of the intentions and expectations of the person? The gulf of evaluation reflects the amount of effort that the person must exert to interpret the physical state of the system and to determine how well the expectations and intentions have been met. The gulf is small when the system provides information about its state in a form that is easy to get, is easy to interpret, and matches the way the person thinks of the system. In the movie projector example, there was also a problem with the gulf of evaluation. Even when the film was in the projector, it was difficult to tell if it had been threaded correctly. With VCRs, all you have to know is whether the cartridge is properly inserted into the machine. If it isn't, usually it won't fit right. It sticks out, obviously, and you know that things are not right. But VCRs aren't perfect either. I remember a conference speaker who pushed the start button on the VCR and told the audience to watch the screen. No picture. She fiddled with the machine, then called for help. One, then two, then three technicians appeared on the scene. They carefully checked the power connections, the leads to the VCR, the circuits. The audience waited impatiently, giggling. Finally, the product was found. There wasn't any tape in the VCR. No tape, no picture. The problem was that once the cartridge door to that particular VCR was shut, there was no visible way to tell whether it contained a tape. Bad design. That gulf of evaluation sunk another user. The gulfs are present to an amazing degree in a variety of devices. Usually, the difficulties are unremarked and invisible. The users either take the blame themselves, in the case of things they believe they should be capable of using, such as water faucets, refrigerator temperature controls, stovetops, radio and television sets, or decide that they are incapable of operating the pesky devices. Sewing machines, washing machines, digital watches, digital controls on household appliances, VCRs, audio sets. These are indeed the gadgets of everyday household use. None of them has a complex structure, yet many of them defeat the otherwise capable user. The seven stages of action as design aids. The seven-stage structure can be a valuable design aid, for it provides a basic checklist of questions to ask to ensure that the gulfs of evaluation and execution are bridged. See Figure 15. In general, each stage of action requires its own special design strategies, and in turn, provides its own opportunity for disaster. It would be fun, were it not also so frustrating, to look over the world and gleefully analyze each deficiency. On the whole, as you can see in Figure 15, the questions for each stage are relatively simple, and these in turn boil down to the principles of good design, introduced in Chapter 1. Visibility. By looking, the user can tell the state of the device and the alternatives for action. A good conceptual model. The designer provides a good conceptual model for the user, with consistency in the presentation of operations and results, and a coherent, consistent system image. Good mappings. It is possible to determine the relationships between actions and results, between the controls and their effects, and between the system state and what is visible. Feedback. The user receives full and continuous feedback about the results of actions. Each point provides support for one or more of the seven stages of action. The next time you can't immediately figure out the shower control in a motel, or work an unfamiliar television set or stove, remember that the problem is in the design. And the next time you pick up an unfamiliar object and use it smoothly and effortlessly on the first try, stop and examine it. The ease of use did not come about by accident. Someone designed the object carefully and well. Chapter 3. Knowledge in the Head and in the World. A friend kindly let me borrow his car. Just before I was about to leave, I found a note waiting for me. I should have mentioned that to get the key out of the ignition, the car needs to be in reverse. The car needs to be in reverse. If I hadn't seen the note, I never could have figured that out. There was no visible cue in the car. The knowledge needed for this trick had to reside in the head. If the driver lacks that knowledge, the key stays in the ignition forever. It is easy to show the faulty nature of human knowledge and memory. A common classroom exercise in the United States demonstrates that students cannot recall the pairing of letters and numbers on their telephones. One of my graduate students found that when professional typists were given caps for typewriter keys, they could not arrange them in the proper configuration. American students dialed telephones properly, and all those typists could type rapidly and accurately. Why the apparent discrepancy between the precision of behavior and the imprecision of knowledge? Because not all of the knowledge required for precise behavior has to be in the head. It can be distributed, partly in the head, partly in the world, and partly in the constraints of the world. Precise behavior can emerge from imprecise knowledge for four reasons. 1. Information is in the world. Much of the information a person needs to do a task can reside in the world. Behavior is determined by combining the information in memory, in the head, with that in the world. 2. Great precision is not required. Precision, accuracy, and completeness of knowledge are seldom required. Perfect behavior will result if the knowledge describes the information or behavior sufficiently to distinguish the correct choice from all others. 3. Natural constraints are present. The world restricts the allowed behavior. The physical properties of objects constrain possible operations. the order in which parts can go together, and the ways in which an object can be moved, picked up, or otherwise manipulated. Each object has physical features, projections, depressions, screw threads, appendages, that limit its relationships to other objects, operations that can be performed to it, what can be attached to it, and so on. 4. Cultural constraints are present. In addition to natural physical constraints, society has evolved numerous artificial conventions that govern acceptable social behavior. These cultural conventions have to be learned, but once learned, they apply to a wide variety of circumstances. Because of these natural and artificial constraints, the number of alternatives for any particular situation is reduced, as are the amount and specificity of knowledge required within human memory. In everyday situations, behavior is determined by the combination of internal knowledge and external information and constraints. People routinely capitalize on this fact. They can minimize the amount of material they must learn, or the completeness, precision, accuracy, or depth of the learning. People can deliberately organize the environment to support their behavior. Some people with brain damage can function so well that even their coworkers may not be aware of their handicap. Non-readers have been known to fool others even in situations where their job presumably requires reading skills. They know what is expected of them, follow the behavior of their coworkers, and set up situations so that they do not need to read or so that their coworkers do the reading for them. What is true in these extreme cases must certainly also be true of ordinary people in ordinary situations. It is only the amount of reliance upon the external world that differs. There is a trade-off between the amount of mental knowledge and the amount of external knowledge required in performing tasks. People are free to operate variously in allowing for this trade-off. Precise behavior from imprecise knowledge. Information is in the world. Whenever information needed to do a task is readily available in the world, the need for us to learn it diminishes. For example, we lack knowledge about common coins, even though we recognize them just fine. See Figure 16. Or consider typing. Many typists have not memorized the keyboard. Usually each letter is labeled, so non-typists can hunt and peck letter by letter, relying on knowledge in the world and minimizing the time required for learning. The problem is that such typing is slow and difficult. With experience, of course, hunt and peck typists learn the positions of many of the letters on the keyboard even without instruction, and typing speed increases notably, quickly surpassing handwriting speeds, and for some reaching quite respectable rates. Peripheral vision and the feel of the keyboard provide some information about key locations. Frequently used keys become completely learned. Infrequently used keys are not learned well, and the other keys are partially learned. But as long as the typist needs to watch the keyboard, the speed is limited. The knowledge is still mostly in the world, not in the head. If a person needs to type large amounts of material regularly, further investment is worthwhile, a course, a book, or an interactive computer program. The important thing is to learn the proper placement of fingers on the keyboard, to learn to type without looking, to get knowledge about the keyboard from the world into the head. It takes several hours to learn the system and several months to become expert, but the payoff of all this effort is increased typing speed, increased accuracy, and decreased mental load and effort at the time of typing. There is a trade-off between speed and quality of performance and mental effort. Thus, in finding your way through a city, locating items in a store or house, or working complex machinery, the trade-off can determine what needs to be learned. Because you know that the information is available in the environment, the information you internally code in memory need be precise enough only to sustain the quality of behavior you desire. This is one reason people can function well in their environment and still be unable to describe what they do. For example, a person can travel accurately through a city without being able to describe the route precisely. People function through their use of two kinds of knowledge, knowledge of and knowledge how. Knowledge of, what psychologists call declarative knowledge, includes the knowledge of facts and rules. Stop at red lights. New York City lies on a parallel a bit south of Madrid. San Diego's longitude is east of Reno. To get the key out of the ignition, the car must be in reverse. Declarative knowledge is easy to write down and to teach. Knowledge how, what psychologists call procedural knowledge, is the knowledge that enables a person to perform music, to stop a car smoothly with a flat tire on an icy road, to return a serve in tennis, or to move the tongue properly when saying the phrase, frightening witches. Procedural knowledge is difficult or impossible to write down, and difficult to teach. It is best taught by demonstration and best learned through practice. Even the best teachers cannot usually describe what they are doing. Procedural knowledge is largely subconscious. Knowledge from the world is usually easy to come by. Designers provide a large number of memory aids. The letters on the typewriter keyboard are one example. The lights and labels on controls act as external memory aids, reminding the user of the purpose and state of the control. Industrial equipment is replete with signal lights, indicators, and other reminders. We make extensive use of written notes. We place items in specific locations as reminders. In general, people structure the environment to provide a considerable amount of the information required for something to be remembered. Many people organize their lives in the world, creating a pile here, a pile there, each indicating some activity to be done, some event in progress. Probably everybody uses such a strategy to some extent. Look around you at the variety of ways people structure their rooms and desks. Many styles of organization are possible, but the physical arrangement and visibility of the items frequently convey information about relative importance. Want to do your friends a nasty turn? Do them a favor. Clean up their desks or rooms. Do this to some people and you can completely destroy their ability to function. Great precision is not required. Normally, people do not need precise memory information. People can remember enough to distinguish one familiar coin from another, although they may be unable to remember the faces, pictures, and words on the coins. But make more precise memory necessary, and you get havoc. Three countries have rediscovered this fact in recent years. The United States, when it introduced the Susan B. Anthony $1 coin. Great Britain, when it introduced the £1 coin. And France, when it introduced a new 10-franc coin. The new U.S. dollar coin was confused with the existing 25-cent piece, the quarter, and the British pound coin was confused with the existing 5-pence piece. The 1-pound coin has the same diameter as the 5-pence piece, but is considerably thicker and heavier. Here is what happened in France. Paris. With a good deal of fanfare, the French government released the new 10-franc coin, worth a little more than $1.50, on October 22, 1986. The public looked at it, weighed it, and began confusing it so quickly with the half-franc coin, worth only 8 cents, that a crescendo of fury and ridicule fell on both the government and the coin. 5 weeks later, Minister of Finance Edouard Balladur suspended circulation of the coin. Within another 4 weeks, he canceled it altogether. In retrospect, the French decision seems so foolish that it is hard to fathom how it could have been made. After much study, designers came up with a silver-colored coin made of nickel and featuring a modernistic drawing by artist Joaquim Jimenez of a Gallic rooster on one side and of Marianne, the female symbol of the French Republic, on the other. The coin was light, sported special ridges on its rim for easy reading by electronic vending machines, and seemed tough to counterfeit. But the designers and bureaucrats were obviously so excited by their creation that they ignored or refused to accept the new coin's similarity to the hundreds of millions of silver-colored, nickel-based, half-franc coins in circulation, whose size and weight were perilously similar. The confusions probably occurred because the users of coins formed representations in their memory systems that were sufficiently precise only to distinguish among the coins that they actually had to use. It is a general property of memory that we store only partial descriptions of the things to be remembered, descriptions that are sufficiently precise to work at the time something is learned, but that may not work later on when new experiences have also been encountered and entered into memory. The descriptions formed to distinguish among the old coins were not precise enough to distinguish between the new one and at least one of the old ones. Suppose I keep all my notes in a small red notebook. If this is my only notebook, I can describe it simply as my notebook. If I buy several more notebooks, the earlier description will no longer work. Now I must call the first one small or red, or maybe both small and red, whichever allows me to distinguish it from the others. But what if I acquire several small red notebooks? Now I must find some other means of describing the first book, adding to the richness of the description, and thereby to its ability to discriminate among the several similar items. Descriptions need discriminate only among the choices in front of me, but what works for one purpose may not for another. The power of constraints. Back in the good old days of oral tradition, and even today for some cultures, performers traveled around reciting epic poems thousands of lines long. How did they do it? Do some people have huge amounts of knowledge in their heads? Not really. It turns out that external constraints exert powerful control over the permissible choice of words, thus dramatically reducing the memory load. Consider the constraints of rhyming. If you wish to rhyme one word with another in English, there are usually 10 to 20 alternatives. But if you must have a word with a particular meaning to rhyme with another, there are usually no candidates at all. And if there are any, in most cases there is only one. Combining the two constraints of rhyme and meaning can therefore reduce the information about the particular word that must be kept in memory to nothing. As long as the constraints are known, the choice of word can be completely determined. The learning of material like poetry is greatly aided by these kinds of constraints, which work on the general schema for the class of poem, meter, and topic. Here is an example. I am thinking of three words. One means a mythical being. The second is the name of a building material. And the third is a unit of time. What words do I have in mind? Although you can probably think of three words that fit the descriptions, you are not likely to get the same three that I have in mind. There simply are not enough constraints. Now try a second task. This time look for rhyming words. I am thinking of three words. One rhymes with post, the second with eel, and the third with ear. What words am I thinking of? Suppose I now tell you that the words I seek are the same in both tasks. What is a word that means a mythical being and rhymes with post? What word is the name of a building material and rhymes with eel? And what word is a unit of time and rhymes with ear? Now the task is easy. The joint specification of the words completely constrains the selection. In the psychology laboratory, people almost never got the correct meanings or rhymes for the first two tasks, but they correctly answered ghost, steel, and year in the combined task almost always. The classic study of memory for epic poetry was done by Albert Bates Lord. He went to Yugoslavia and found people who still followed the oral tradition. He demonstrated that the singer of tales, the person who learns epic poems and goes from village to village reciting them, is really recreating them, composing poetry on the fly in such a way that it obeys the rhythm, theme, storyline, structure, and other characteristics of the poem. This is a prodigious feat, but it is not an example of rote memory. Rather, the practice illustrates the immense power of the multiple constraints that allow the singer to listen to another singer tell a lengthy tale once, and then, after a delay of a few hours or a day, apparently recite the same song, word for word and line for line. In fact, as Lord points out, the original and new recitations are not the same word for word, but the listener would perceive them as the same, even if the second version were twice as long as the first. They are the same in the ways that matter to the listener. They tell the same story, express the same ideas, and follow the same rhyme and meter. They are the same in all senses that matter to the culture. Lord shows just how the combination of memory for poetics, theme, and style combine with cultural structures into what he calls a formula for producing an appropriate poem, perceived as identical to earlier recitations. The notion that someone should be able to recite word for word is relatively modern. Such a notion can be held only after printed texts become available. Otherwise, who could judge the accuracy of a recitation? Perhaps more important, who would care? All this is not to detract from the feat. Learning and reciting an epic poem such as Homer's Odyssey or Iliad is clearly difficult even if the singer is recreating it. There are 27,000 lines of verse in the written version. Most of us do not learn epic poems, but we do make use of strong constraints that serve to simplify what must be retained in memory. Consider an example from a completely different domain, taking apart and reassembling a mechanical device. Typical items in the home that an adventuresome person might attempt to repair include a door lock, toaster, and washing machine. The device is apt to have tens of parts. What has to be remembered in order to put the parts together again in proper order? Not as much as might appear from an initial analysis. In the extreme case, if there are 10 parts, there are 10. 10 factorial, 10 times 9 times 8, different ways in which to reassemble them. A little over 3.5 million alternatives. But never can all possible orderings be produced. There will be a number of physical constraints on the ordering. Some pieces must be assembled before it is even possible to assemble the others. Some pieces are physically constrained from fitting into the spots reserved for others. Bolts must fit into holes of an appropriate diameter and depth. Nuts and washers must be paired with bolts and screws of appropriate sizes. And washers must always be put on before nuts. There are even cultural constraints. We turn screws clockwise to tighten, counterclockwise to loosen. The heads of screws tend to go on the visible part, front or top of a piece, bolts on the less visible part, bottom, side, or interior of a piece. Wood screws and machine screws look different and are inserted into different kinds of materials. In the end, the apparently large number of decisions is reduced to only a few choices that should have been learned or otherwise noted during the disassembly. The constraints by themselves are often not sufficient to determine the proper reassembly of the device. Mistakes do get made, but the constraints reduce the amount that must be learned to a reasonable quantity. Memory is knowledge in the head. Remember the story of Ali Baba and the 40 thieves? Ali Baba discovered the secret words that opened the thieves' cave. His brother-in-law Qasim forced him to reveal the secret. Qasim then went to the cave. When he reached the entrance of the cavern, he pronounced the words, "Open Shimshim." The door immediately opened, and when he was in, closed on him. In examining the cave, he was greatly astonished to find much more riches than he had expected from Ali Baba's relation. He quickly laid at the door of the cavern as many bags of gold as his 10 mules could carry. But his thoughts were now so full of the great riches he should possess that he could not think of the necessary words to make the door open. Instead of "open shimshim," he said "open barley," and was much amazed to find that the door remained shut. He named several sorts of grain, but still the door would not open. Qasim never expected such an incident, and was so alarmed at the danger he was in that the more he endeavored to remember the word simsim, the more his memory was confounded, and he had as much forgotten it as if he had never heard it mentioned. Qasim never got out. The thieves returned, cut off Qasim's head, and quartered his body. The conspiracy against memory. Most of us will not get our heads cut off if we fail to remember a secret code, but it can still be very hard to do. It is one thing to have to memorize one or two secrets, a combination, or a password, or the secret to opening the door. But when the number of secret codes gets too large, memory fails. There seems to be a conspiracy, one calculated to destroy our sanity by overloading our memory. Consider what we are asked to remember in our convenient world. A simple search through my own wallet and papers reveals the following things. postal codes ranging in the United States from the short form of 5 digits to the long form of 9. Human short-term memory can comfortably retain only a 5 to 7 digit number, yet here I am asked to use 9. I need to know the code for where I live, the code for where I work, the codes for my parents and for my children, the codes for my friends, and the codes for anyone with whom I correspond regularly. American codes such as 92014-6207, British codes such as WC1N3BG, Canadian codes such as M6P2V8, all for the sake of the machinery, and despite the fact that addresses are perfectly sensible and normally unambiguous. But machines have trouble with addresses, whereas they can deal with simple postal codes. Telephone numbers, sometimes with area codes and extensions. A 7-digit number becomes 10 when the area code is added, and then 14 when there is a 4-digit extension. International codes with country code and city code add more digits. How many telephone numbers must I know? More than I wish to contemplate. All my personal contacts. Numbers for information, time, and weather. The special number for emergencies. And I mustn't forget to dial 9, or in some cases 8, so that the call will go outside the institution or company. Access numbers for telephone budget cards, so that when I make a long-distance call from my university, I can cause the correct account to pay the bill. A 5-digit number for each account, and I have 4 of them. Don't show these to anyone, I am warned. Keep them hidden in a secret place. Access numbers for telephone credit cards, so when I travel, I can have the bill automatically put on my home telephone number. The codes consist of my home telephone number plus 4 secret digits. The secret digits aren't even printed on the card. Memorize and destroy. But I have 6 of them. 2 home phone accounts and 4 different university phone accounts. If I want to dial a long-distance number from a hotel using one of my telephone credit cards, I must dial as many as 36 digits. Passwords or numbers for bank automatic teller machines. Those clever machines that let you put in a card, type in your secret password, and get money. 2 bank accounts, 2 secret passwords. Don't write them down. A thief might see them. Memorize, memorize. Secret passwords for my computer accounts. Can't let people steal my valuable data, or perhaps change their course grades, or peek at the examination questions. Make the password at least 6 characters long, we are told. And no words. Words are too easy for someone to discover. Make it nonsense. I cheat and make all my computer accounts use the same password. Driver's license number. When I lived briefly in Texas, I couldn't do anything without my driver's license number. Not pay for food at the supermarket, not pay the telephone bill, not even open up a bank account. That was 1 letter, 7 digits. Other states have longer numbers. Social security numbers for me, my wife, and my children. 9 digits each. Passport numbers, again for my whole family. My employee number. License plate numbers for our cars. Birthdays. Ages. Clothing sizes. Addresses. Credit card numbers. Bah and humbug. So many of these numbers and codes must be kept secret. Apparently, thieves are everywhere just waiting for me to write down my secret password or number, anxious to make that phone call on my account or to purchase items with my charge card. There is no way that I can learn all those numbers. And they keep changing anyway, some of them annually. I even have trouble remembering how old I am. It changes every year, too. Quick, what magic phrase was Kasim trying to remember to open the cavern door? How can we remember all these things? Most of us can't, even with the use of mnemonics to make some sense of nonsensical material. Books and courses on improving memory can work, but the methods are laborious to learn and need continued practice to maintain. So we put the memory in the world, writing things down in books, on scraps of paper, even on the backs of our hands. But we disguise them to thwart would-be thieves. That creates another problem. How do we disguise the items? How do we hide them? And how do we remember what the disguise was or where we put them? Ah, the foibles of memory. Where should you hide something so that nobody else will find it? in unlikely places, right? Money is hidden in the freezer, jewelry in the medicine cabinet or in shoes in the closet. The key to the front door is hidden under the mat or just below the window ledge. The car key is under the bumper. The love letters are in a flower vase. The problem is, there aren't that many unlikely places in your home. You may not remember where the love letters or keys are hidden, but your burglar will. Two psychologists who examined the issue described the problem this way. There is often a logic involved in the choice of unlikely places. For example, a friend of ours was required by her insurance company to acquire a safe if she wished to insure her valuable gems. Recognizing that she might forget the combination to the safe, she thought very carefully about where to keep the combination. Her solution was to write it in her personal phone directory under the letter S, next to Mr. and Mrs. Safe, as if it were a telephone number. There is a clear logic here. Store numerical information with other numerical information. She was appalled, however, when she heard a reformed burglar on a daytime television talk show say that upon encountering a safe, he always headed for the phone directory because many people keep the combination there. All these numbers to remember add up to unwitting tyranny. It is time for a revolt. The structure of memory. Say aloud the numbers 1, 7, 4, 2, 8. Next, without looking back, repeat them. Try again if you must, perhaps closing your eyes, the better to hear the sound still echoing in mental activity. Have someone read a random sentence to you. What were the words? The memory of the just present is available immediately, clear and complete, without mental effort. What did you eat for dinner 3 days ago? Now the feeling is different. It takes time to recover the answer, which is neither as clear nor as complete a remembrance as that of the just present, and the recovery is likely to require considerable mental effort. Retrieval of the past differs from retrieval of the just present. More effort is required, less clarity results. Indeed, the past need not be so long ago. Without looking back, what were those digits? For some people, this retrieval now takes time and effort. Psychologists distinguish between two major classes of memory, short-term memory and long-term memory, abbreviated STM and LTM, respectively. The two are quite different. Short-term memory is the memory of the just present. Information is retained in it automatically and retrieved without effort. But the amount of information that can be retained this way is severely limited. Something like 5 to 7 items is the limit of STM, with the number going to 10 or 12 if a person also rehearses, mentally repeating the items to be retained. Short-term memory is invaluable in the performance of everyday tasks, in letting us remember words, names, phrases, and parts of tasks. It acts as a working or temporary memory, but the memory is quite fragile. Get distracted by some other activity and poof, the stuff in STM disappears. It is capable of holding a 5-digit postal code or 7-digit telephone number from the time you look them up until the time they are used, as long as no distractions occur. 9 or 10-digit numbers give trouble. And when the number starts to exceed that, don't bother. Write it down. Or divide the number into several shorter segments. Long-term memory is memory for the past. As a rule, it takes time to put stuff away in LTM and time and effort to get it out again. This is how we maintain our experiences, not as an exact recording of the events, but as interpreted through our understanding of them, subject to all the distortions and changes that the human explanatory mechanism imposes upon life. How well we can ever recover experiences and knowledge from LTM is highly dependent upon how the material was interpreted in the first place. What is stored in LTM under one interpretation probably cannot be found later on when sought under some other interpretation. As for how large the memory is, nobody really knows. Billions of items, probably. One informed scientist estimates the capacity as 1,000,000 × 10^9 bits, or about 100,000,000 × 10^8 items. Whatever the size, it is so large as not to impose any practical limit. The difficulty with LTM is in organization, in getting material in and in figuring out how to retrieve it, not in capacity. Storage and retrieval are easier when the material makes sense, when it fits into what is already known. When the material makes no sense, it will have to be worked on, structured, and interpreted, until finally it can be retained. Human memory is essentially knowledge in the head, or internal knowledge. If we examine how people use their memories and how they retrieve information, we discover a number of categories. Three are important for us now. 1. Memory for arbitrary things. The items to be retained seem arbitrary, with no meaning and no particular relationship to one another or to things already known. 2. Memory for meaningful relationships. The items to be retained form meaningful relationships with themselves or with other things already known. 3. Memory through explanation. The material does not have to be remembered, but rather can be derived from some explanatory mechanism. Memory for arbitrary things. Arbitrary knowledge can be classified as the simple remembering of what is to be done without reliance on an understanding of why or on internal structure. This is how we learn the alphabet and how to tie a shoelace. It is even how we learn the multiplication tables, that 3 times 2 is 6, although for that we could refer to an external structure. This is how we are expected to learn arbitrary codes to operate the modern misbegotten telephone system. It is also how we are forced to learn many procedures required of modern technology. To load this program, put the floppy diskette into drive A and type Alt Mode Control Shift X Delete. This is rote learning, the bane of modern existence. Rote learning creates problems. First, because what is being learned is arbitrary, the learning is difficult. It can take considerable time and effort. Second, when a problem arises, the memorized sequence of actions gives no hint of what has gone wrong, no suggestion of what might be done to fix the problem. Although some things are appropriate to learn by rote, the letters of the alphabet, for example, most are not. Alas, it is still the dominant method of instruction in many school systems, and even for much adult training. This is how some people are taught to use computers or to cook. It is how we have to learn to use some of the new, poorly designed gadgets of our technology. Most psychologists would argue that it is not really possible to learn arbitrary associations or sequences. Even where there appears to be no structure, people manufacture some artificial and usually rather unsatisfactory one, which is why the learning is so bad. For our purposes, it does not matter whether arbitrary learning is impossible or simply very difficult. The end result is the same. It is not the best way to go, not if there is any choice in the matter. Thus, in teaching the alphabet, we try to make it into a tune, using the natural constraints of rhyme and rhythm to simplify the memory load. People who have learned to use computers or cook by rote are probably not very good. Since they do not understand the reasons for their actions, they must find tasks arbitrary and strange. When something goes wrong, they don't know what to do, unless they've memorized solutions. Although rote learning is at times necessary or efficient, so that emergency procedures for things like high-speed military jet aircraft are handled quickly, automatically when the need arises, on the whole, it is most unsatisfactory. Memory for meaningful relationships. Most things in the world have a sensible structure, which tremendously simplifies the memory task. When things make sense, they correspond to knowledge that we already have, so the new material can be understood, interpreted, and integrated with previously acquired material. Now we can use rules and constraints to help understand what things go together. Meaningful structure can organize apparent chaos and arbitrariness. Remember the discussion of mental models in Chapter 2? Part of the power of a good mental model lies in its ability to provide meaning to things. Let's look at an example to show how a meaningful interpretation transforms an apparently arbitrary task into a natural one. Note that the appropriate interpretation may not at first be obvious. It, too, is knowledge and has to be discovered. A Japanese colleague, call him Mr. Tanaka, had difficulty remembering how to use the turn signal switch on his motorcycle's left handlebar. Moving the switch forward signaled a right turn, backward a left turn. The meaning of the switch was clear and unambiguous, but the direction in which it should be moved was not. Tanaka kept thinking that because the switch was on the left handlebar, pushing it forward should signal a left turn. That is, he was trying to map the action, push the left switch forward, to the intention, turn left, which was wrong. As a result, he had trouble remembering which switch direction should be used for which turning direction. Most motorcycles have the turn signal switch mounted differently, rotated 90 degrees, so that moving it left signals a left turn, moving it right a right turn. This mapping is easy to learn. It is a natural mapping. But the turn switch on Tanaka's motorcycle moved forward and back, not left and right. How could he learn it? Mr. Tanaka solved the problem by reinterpreting the action. Consider the way the handlebars of the motorcycle turn. For a left turn, the left handlebar moves backward. For a right turn, the left handlebar moves forward. The required switch movements exactly paralleled the handlebar movements. If the task is reconceptualized as signaling the direction of motion of the handlebars rather than the direction of the motorcycle, the switch motion can be seen to mimic the desired motion. Finally, we have a natural mapping. At first, the motion of the switch seemed arbitrary, indirect, and difficult to remember. With the proper interpretation, the switch motion is direct and logical, and as a result, easy to learn and to use. A meaningful relationship can be indispensable, but you have to have the right one. Without the proper interpretation, it was difficult to remember the switch directions. With it, both the remembering and the performance of the task became trivial. Note that Tanaka's interpretation of the switch movement did not explain anything. It simply let him relate the proper direction to move the switch with the direction in which he was turning the motorcycle. The interpretation is essential, but it should not be confused with understanding. Memory through explanation. Now we come to a different, more powerful form of internal memory. Understanding. People are explanatory creatures, as I showed in Chapter 2. Explanations and interpretations of events are fundamental to human performance, both in understanding the world and in learning and remembering. Here, mental models play a major role. Mental models simplify learning, in part because the details of the required behavior can be derived when needed. They can be invaluable in dealing with unexpected situations. Note that the use of mental models to remember, in this case, derive, behavior, is not ideal for tasks that must be done rapidly and smoothly. The derivation takes time and requires mental resources, neither of which may be in great supply during critical incidents. Mental models let people derive appropriate behavior for situations that are not remembered or never before encountered. People probably make up mental models for most of the things they do. This is why designers should provide users with appropriate models. When they are not supplied, people are likely to make up inappropriate ones. The sewing machine provides a good example of the power of a mental model. A sewing machine is a mysterious beast, managing to loop an upper thread through a lower thread, even though each thread is always connected to its spool or bobbin, respectively. The mental model has to explain how the upper thread goes through the material being sewn, dips under the surface plate, and then loops around the lower thread. The proper model, it turns out, is something like this. Picture the lower bobbin held gently in the machine by a kind of cup with sloping sides. The cup keeps the bobbin stable, allowing it to rotate so its thread can be unwound. Yet the cup is loose enough so that the upper thread can go inside the cup and around the bobbin, and therefore around the bottom thread. When the upper needle goes through the material and under the plate, a rotating hook grabs its thread and guides it between the inner walls of the cup and the outer walls of the bobbin case. This helps explain why the machine won't work properly if the bobbin is bent, even if the bobbin still appears to fit and the bottom thread unrolls properly. It explains why dirt on the bobbin or in the cup will mess things up, and why certain kinds of upper thread might cause more trouble than others. A thick upper thread, especially one that was rough or sticky, might not go smoothly around the bobbin. To be honest, I don't know if anything I just said about the failures of bobbins is true. I derived each example from my mental model of a sewing machine. I can't sew. But when Naomi Miyake did her research for her doctoral thesis in my laboratory, she studied people's understanding of sewing and of the machines. The result was twofold: a fine piece of research for her and a mental model for me. So now I can derive what would happen even if it has never happened to me. The power of mental models is that they let you figure out what would happen in novel situations. Or if you are actually doing the task and there is a problem, they let you figure out what is happening. If the model is wrong, you will be wrong too. Am I right about the sewing machine? Decide for yourself. Go look at one. After word got out that I was collecting instances of design peculiarities, a friend reported the following about the sunroof of his new car, an Audi. Supposedly, if the ignition is not on, the sunroof cannot be operated. However, a mechanic explained that you could close the sunroof even without the ignition key if you turned on the headlights and then one pulled back on the turn signal stalk, which normally switches the headlights to high beam, and two pushed the close control of the sunroof. My friend said that it was thoughtful of Audi to provide this override of the ignition key in case the sunroof was open when it started raining. You could close it even if you didn't have your key. But we both wondered why the sequence was so peculiar. Ever skeptical, I asked to see the manual for the car. The manual was explicit. You cannot work the sunroof if the ignition is off. A similar statement appeared in the discussion of the electrically powered windows. My friend's mental model was functional. It explained why you would want such a feature, but not how it worked. If the feature was so desirable, why was it not mentioned in the manual? We searched for another explanation. Perhaps it wasn't a design feature after all. Perhaps it was an accident of design. Perhaps turning on the lights and pulling back on the stalk connected the electrical power to the car, overriding the fact that the ignition key was off. This would allow the sunroof to work, but only as a byproduct of the way the lights were wired. This model was more specific. It explained what was happening and allowed us to predict that all electrical items should work. So we checked. Turning on the light switch without engaging the ignition did not turn on the headlights. Only the parking lights went on. But when we also pulled back on the turn signal stalk, the headlights did turn on, even though the ignition was off. With the stalk pulled back, the sunroof would close and open. The windows would close and open. The fan on the heating system worked. So did the radio. This was an effective mental model. Now we could understand better what was happening, predict new results, and more easily remember the peculiar set of operations required for the task. Memory is also knowledge in the world. As we have seen, knowledge in the world, external knowledge, can be very valuable, but it too has drawbacks. For one, it is available only if you are there in the appropriate situation. When you are somewhere else, or if the world has changed meanwhile, the knowledge is gone. The critical memory aids provided by the external information are absent, and so the task or item may not be remembered. A folk saying captures this situation well: out of sight, out of mind. Reminding. One of the most important and interesting aspects of the role of external memory is reminding, a good example of the interplay between knowledge in the head and in the world. Suppose a neighboring family asks you to take them to the airport. You agree to take them next Saturday at 3:30 p.m. Now the knowledge is in your head, but how are you going to remember it at the proper time? You will need to be reminded. There are many strategies for reminding. One is simply to keep the information in your head. If the event is important enough, you count on having it come repeatedly to mind, what psychologists call rehearsal, so that you can simply assume that there will be no difficulty at all remembering when to leave on Saturday. You can keep the information in your head, especially when the event is of great personal importance. Suppose you are catching the plane for your first trip to Paris. You won't have any problem remembering. But keeping the knowledge in your head is not ordinarily a good reminding technique. Suppose the event is not personally important. It is several days away and you are leading a very busy life. Now, you'd better transfer some of the burden of remembering to the outside world. Here is where you use notes to yourself, or pocket and desk calendars, or diaries, or electronic alarms that can be set for time.